So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Reuben.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Well, we know he loaded up that elbow with something to clobber you like that, but you came out of it. You're still the America's champion, America's hero, Sergeant Slaughter.
Well, I don't know what he hit me with, but it almost knocked me out, knocked me silly. Got a good gash in my head, but I told him, I'm telling any other foreign wrestler, I declared war on you. We're going to clean up America of trash and scum and maggots like you, because we don't need you. It's the American way when you live here. It's Slaughter's way. G.I. Joe, Yo Joe, as you can see by my outfit from head to toe, I'm G.I. Joe. And wherever I go, USA will always be number one, always has been USA.
Bloodied but not bound, victorious, America's champion is still Sergeant Slaughter.
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock, along with Wei Ting. And this week, we've got a hell of a review coming your way. How are things, Wei?
Pretty good, man.
You have had...
Oh, man, I can't lie. I'm very tired.
You have had a hangover from doing the Law Sunday night. It is now Wednesday.
How do you do it, man?
I'm used to it.
How do you do it every single week?
What are you feeling at this moment?
Last night? Okay, not last night.
Felt like last night.
Yeah, felt like last night. I'm still hungover. But, I mean, Sunday began bright and early at 6:30 p.m.
6:30 p.m., I came to pick you up, and then we went off to pick up Dan Lavransky.
Yeah.
And then we went to go get some food for the show.
The teriyaki experience.
Wei Ting with the highlight of the night for us. We decided we...
Well, our options were...
Mr. Sub, Starbucks, or... The teriyaki experience.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't usually join you guys for the law, for these pay-per-view nights. So I ask, hey, what do you guys usually go to? And John's like, oh, we usually go to this Mr. Sub. But right next to the Mr. Sub is a teriyaki experience.
And we have never experienced the teriyaki.
You have not experienced, but I have. I hate to play the stereotype.
They're a big fan of yours.
Well, I hate to play the stereotype, but I mean, come on. Amongst the fast food chains, it is up there for me.
So when Dan Lavransky ended the show saying that all we have to do to get Wei to come is feed him teriyaki,
it was actually
not some stereotypical comment,
no.
But rather specific to our dinner choice.
It was very funny when Mouth said that, because out of context, it would sound... rather amusing, but otherwise it still only sounds just... It sounds amusing anyway. But anyway, the teriyaki experience, it's... What did you think? Your first experience with the teriyaki.
Well, the experience was glowing, I thought. We went in, very simple to order.
Yeah.
I accidentally, mistakenly ordered the soup, and then he looked at me. He was like, you sure you want the soup?
The noodle soup. So you basically, if you've never been to the teriyaki experience... It's apparently an Oakville-based fast food chain, but they essentially just make meat and rice or noodles. Okay,
it is seen in every single food court in Toronto.
Yeah, so
I think everyone that you have to open with a teriyaki experience.
Perhaps, yes. So
the bylaw.
So it's like, you know, you basically either choose a rice dish, a noodle dish with soup, a noodle dish without soup, and you choose your meat on top of that. It's either for shrimp, chicken, beef. Very simple. And you happen to choose the noodle with soup first. And then ultimately...
He could tell by my delivery that that is not what I want.
He's like, are you sure? Are you sure you want to do that?
Whenever someone is behind the counter and says, are you sure? You always make a new choice.
See, but I'm typically a noodle with soup guy. So I would have actually been like, yeah, I'm sure. You don't have to ask me twice.
Well, but I ended up getting the just regular noodles with beef.
Without soup.
Without soup.
Yes, and then they cook it for you. They have that hot grill in front of them, and they cook everything fresh for you.
Yeah, they make it in under 10 minutes. Yeah. My only regret was not getting two of them, to be honest.
You know what? The portions could be a little...
Yeah, because we had this. I mean, this was also... This is an endurance on a pay-per-view night, Way. We are going from 7 p.m. till 2 in the morning when the show ends. So that's a long, long damn time.
Yeah, that is true. Because not only do... You know, I never do this, but I mean... We watch the pre-show as well.
Yes. You know, you have, why, we don't know.
That is the job, of course. You got to cover this five-man elimination tag team match between... It was important. Goldust return.
Yes. And Way was kind of... I mean, he was kind of held captive because typically Way will just come, he'll meet us, and he's in his car. And I can understand this because I myself, when I'm going places, I like to have my car. So I've always got my out. Or for Way... He could have arrived late, but by me picking you up, Way, you were stuck watching this entire thing. Mm-hmm. You're stranded.
No, it's fine. I really didn't mind it at all because, like I said in previous weeks, I was actually looking forward to this show. So I wanted to watch the whole show. And there was really never a point during the actual pay-per-view that I was – actually, I lied again because there were definitely points where I wish I could have fast-forwarded the live show, as I'm used to watching wrestling now, you know, just simply through all the entrances. I'll tell you, one of the most unbearable parts is when they cut to the panel with Renee, Booker, and Byron.
Byron Saxton.
Oh, God. Some of the drivel that comes out of these people's mouths.
One day when people say, what is it about WWE that just the characters just don't connect? I'm just going to show them Byron Saxton on that panel because he represents – listen, he is probably – they probably love him. He is probably the prototype of what they want that role to be.
Absolutely.
And I find it is the least genuine delivery I ever hear on a WWE broadcast when he is describing this feud between The Undertaker and Bray Wyatt. Yeah. And his analogy is that it's kind of like a child – going into his dad's closet and putting on his clothes and realizing I look better in these clothes than my dad.
No. Hmm. Listen, it's not even something that like I would completely blame Byron Saxton for. Like,
no, in fact, I would say he is performing the job exactly how they want.
Yes.
And I bet they are over the moon with Byron Saxton.
Yeah. But to me, though, it's almost more representative of how bad a lot of TV is in general. I mean, it's these types of meaningless bullshit chats where people don't really talk like themselves aren't exclusive to professional wrestling. You turn on any newscast, local newscast, you hear some of the banter between newscasters in between news stories as they go to break, you know?
I'm going to segue off here. We know somebody that works in media. I'm going to spare the name. But someone we worked with who recently had an on-screen moment.
Oh, yes.
Where they accidentally said something they were not supposed to.
Uh-huh.
Now, Way, if you were talking to me right now.
And it became a meme.
Yes.
It became a viral sensation.
So, and this thing got millions of views.
Yeah, it was a Freudian slip.
Sure.
That was captured on camera.
And I watched this, and I was like, this is not even anything. If you and I, in this context, if I were talking to you, Way, and I accidentally said something about, Way, we're going to go watch Nick, perform a magic trick. Horrible analogy. Byron Saxton analogy for you.
It rhymes.
Who cares? Who cares? Oh, he said Dick by mistake, but because... It's somebody on television in a place where you're not allowed to say that word and you're not allowed to go out of this little box that you're supposed to perform in as a broadcaster. It's a big deal because we gotcha. You fucked up.
It would be like, I mean, people in, I guess, traditional forms of broadcast or more conservative forms of broadcasting are supposed to be like robots. They're supposed to only, you know, talk in the way that you would expect them to talk. And if they divert from that in any way, you know, I think the typical viewer is quick to point the finger and say, hey, I caught you.
Like, how unnatural would it be, Wei, if we were doing this on TV and I threw to you and said, Wei, in 30 seconds, tell me about your why you're tired.
I would suck at that. Now, I would hate doing that.
Now, you have to identify your location. You have to address me.
Yeah.
And then you have to do a sign-off. And you have to have the proper language to identify our network.
Well, not to mention that...
Because we have a style guide.
Not to mention that I would never, ever be able to go on air sounding tired. That just wouldn't be allowed.
Okay. We are now going to Wei Ting, who is live at the Oakville headquarters of the Teriyaki Experience, because they have just come out with a brand new shrimp beef tofu combo soup. Wei, is this accurate? Well, thank you, John. Teriyaki Experience CEO. Dan Lofer has confirmed that tofu is going to be migrating into the menu at the Teriyaki Experience. This is not going to be just specific to soup combinations, but rumor has it that udon noodles will also be incorporating the new tofu implosion here at Teriyaki Experience. For Channel 5, Fuck You TV, I'm Wei Ting.
That's really good.
What a horrible... Like, that's not a human speaking. It's a robot.
I would watch that, though.
And I understand the coincidence of you and I talking about this.
It's very passionate. Yeah. I mean, it's but it's different. And somebody like you, I think, is perfect to speak on this because you fulfill both of these roles. You work in a setting like a podcast where you can, you know, you're not really held to those same standards. And that's for better or worse. I'd say, especially for somebody like me, it's for the better. I wouldn't necessarily be able to do what you do on TV.
Could you imagine this show having a producer who after every show would sit us down and say, oh, Wei, we need more high energy from you.
Yeah.
And guys, I don't want you drinking coffee. It's a little unprofessional. We've got to cut out the language because we want to put this on television. And I mean, all that stuff at the beginning, this is a review show. You have to get right to it. Mm-hmm. And more arguments. I mean, both of you like this match. Devil's advocate. Like, you've taken away everything that the show is.
Yeah.
Because you have constructed in your mind what you want the show to be. And just because your label is producer, you supersede what is just natural conversation.
And let's say that producer has that idea. Well, where did that producer get that idea of the show from? Probably from watching another show that copied a previous show that came before it. And because
15 years ago, it was instilled in him that you have to have an argument for every point that is made. And it's always been, that is your answer.
Well, there's no rather than
an opinion. Yeah.
There's no doubt that, like, you know, probably in many instances, those arguments can be organic. And that's when the shows are probably at the best. But when something like that is forced or when... You know, basically, that's part of the reason why everything looks the same in TV.
Imagine I argued with you about every match on this show. I'd let you go first, and I'd take the opposite position. How dull would that be, and how annoyed would you be that it's just, there's no real...
If there was a genuine argument to be had, then sure. But, I mean, if it's forced, then I think our audiences are smart enough these days to be able to tell when something's forced. Anyway, back to our point.
Back to the Teriyaki Experience.
No, back to the WWE panel is what... What I was saying.
I want to get back to teriyaki.
I'm just saying, like, you know, this is not a problem that's completely just you find only in the WWE broadcast. But I'm saying that's when TV is the most creating to me. When I see something that I'm just like, what am I listening to here? What the fuck are you talking about? And how is this benefiting me? How are you educating me? How are you getting me more excited? What positive benefit is me watching you? You got the four of you guys talk. How are you providing anything for me? And I get nothing out of it because I know that these aren't your genuine thoughts. I know not to say you need genuine thoughts in a professional wrestling context. It's all for show anyway. Yes, but I just imagine
the panel, though, Wei, that was installed as an answer to actual panel discussions that you have on major sports broadcasts.
Yes.
And believe me, you watch. This has always been a criticism of NFL rights holders and how critical they are of Roger Goodell, of serious issues in the NFL. I think that it's certainly something that, you know, it's not as if sports is just completely transparent with their thoughts. However, I think there's much more of a closer analysis and journalistic approach as best they can deliver.
For instance, the UFC broadcasts, they've recently started to go to back to the desk for, you know, let's say Daniel Cormier or Rashad Evans takes. And obviously there's a real benefit to those, you know, because you get a professional reaction to what you're actually seeing. In the WWE, I mean, visually, I suppose it breaks up the show, gives you something kind of different to look at rather than just an interview backstage or something like that. But the content is just, it makes me stupid. It makes me really dumb. It makes me feel really dumb. And I think it makes anybody who listens to it a little bit dumber.
Go watch an episode of, you know, primetime wrestling back in the day when they would have conversations with the announcers and they'd have them at the desk.
Yeah.
It's the exact same premise.
Or this show.
But they weren't scripting it.
Yeah, like, and the point is, I feel like those segments at the panels, they can be used creatively. They can be used, like.
I think you can do it in character and still make it entertaining and engaging. But when Byron Saxton gives, they always start the panel off the top. Each one of them has a crafted line to try and, it's like, who can be the most clever to tee up the show? And it's just so painful. Yeah. And Corey Graves, it's night and day because on NXT, you hear him with a completely different voice when he's with Rich Brennan, even Byron Saxton, those three on NXT. I typically enjoy the announcing in NXT.
Mm-hmm.
And on that panel, I think there's just so many constraints that they work under that it's, what are you trying to accomplish here?
Yeah, great question.
What on-air personalities do you like?
I think Renee is fantastic. She leads that panel, yes. And but I think she's great. I think she's probably,
she's a natural backstage improviser.
Yeah.
And that comes through on all broadcasts with her.
Yep. And I mean, having seen some of her work with Jason at Byte doing some comedy stuff, I think they haven't really even utilized her to her greatest potential. Not that I would ever necessarily want to see her in any type of angle on TV.
Glad they've kept her away from that.
But I think she does have that capability. You know, I think she seems very smart and she seems like a good performer overall. So I'm a big fan of hers. I think they're all talented. Listen, you have to be very talented to be hired by that organization. It's just simply maybe the direction that the talent is given, the roles that they're supposed to provide. I don't know. It's a different product now than it is back, you know, let's say in the Mean Gene days.
Well, we're going to go back to the good old days way of September of 1985. It was a wild time in the history of professional wrestling. The WWF had presented the very first WrestleMania earlier that year, and the outside territories, a number of them banded together for a little outfit known as Pro Wrestling USA. And they staged together this show at Comiskey Park in Chicago, Illinois on September the 28th, featuring talent from the AWA, Jim Crockett Promotions, which was really on fire in 1985. They were hardly, I would say, struggling in 1985. And World Class, which was still, I mean, this was after David had passed away, but still at a time when they had had tons of success coming off the Freebirds and Von Erichs. And, man, you would see here with Kerry on this show the level of star this guy was, because World Class was syndicated into different markets in the U.S. And of course, as well, we had talent from the AWA.
This show took place in September of 1985?
Yes.
And that was just 6 months after WrestleMania 1. So how much of, how much of this was a reaction to WrestleMania?
I think the whole concept of Pro Wrestling USA was a reaction to not just WrestleMania, but the WWF further expanding into all of these territories, going national. And the method that the WWF went about was purchasing television time in all these different territories. And what they would do was they'd go into a new territory, find the top star from that local territory and bring them over so that here's this new wrestling programming on your television and we're going to get familiar talent. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of the WWF spending a lot and then hoping to make a lot of it back with the first WrestleMania. So these promoters were somewhat, I think, paranoid that the WWF was going to be rating all of them and thought working together to put on some kind of super show could combat the WWF, clearly based on history and where Pro Wrestling USA went, it was a failed experiment, but this was one of the shows they had to produce.
Now, this was also, it seemed like it was an AWA production, right? AWA was the logo in the ring. They use the primarily, I think mostly their talent.
Yeah, amongst all these different promotions that were working together, they could only come up with one play-by-play announcer to represent everybody because poor Larry Nelson called this entire card alone. Mm-hmm. I thought he was on the verge of just a collapse at the end of this show. But Larry Nelson, I thought, great voice, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
A guy that I didn't grow up with the AWA, so I didn't get to see a whole hell of a lot of it outside of just going back now and watching certain stuff from the AWA. But I've got to say, I am always going to applaud someone that does a one-man call for this amount of time with so much different talent, a lot of outside talent. What were your impressions of Larry Nelson?
I thought he was excellent.
Yeah.
I thought it was tremendous. I mean, I don't necessarily know the landscape of wrestling commentary at the time, but to hear him compared to a lot of the commentary that we've had over the past decade plus, I think
he's not an announcer that his name comes up when you talk about great announcers of the 80s.
And that's unfortunate, but I thought he was great. I thought his voice added a lot of credibility to the matches because he took a lot of it seriously, was very familiar with gave great context even to the Japanese stars on the show, Dos Caras, who's on the show, Mil Mascaras, who was on the show. I thought he was tremendous. But I feel like there might be some contention about whether or not this was done live. It confused me, and I've been jumping back and forth, throughout watching this show, whether or not this commentary was recorded live, because it sounded like, my initial impression was that, man, this sounds like really clean, and I suppose I've been around audio long enough that I can kind of tell when audio is pre-recorded versus or recorded live versus when it's recorded after the fact.
In WWE when there's clearly an insert.
You can usually tell because usually some crowd noise kind of leaks in, and more than anything, when you're talking in a live setting, calling a show in a live setting, you got to talk in a higher register. You're not talking in a quiet room like we are right now. You got to talk like this. Which is that's the loudest I've shouted in 5 years. Probably.
Yeah, look at that peak.
Yeah, but he didn't sound like he was necessarily talking over other people. But then there are parts of the show you could see him ringside.
Oh, he's clearly there.
In fact, there was one shot where they did an over the shoulder of him calling, referring to himself.
That's
in the monitor.
That's me.
Yeah, and you can see him talk. But what? So I thought, oh, clearly he's doing this live. But what also confused me after the fact was that, and we'll talk about this as we do the review, the version that we saw on TV here had a rejigged order of matches from what probably took place live.
Yes.
Live, the show ended with the AWA championship match between Rick Martel and
Stan Hansen.
And Stan Hansen.
And what a great way to go off.
Well, it was only a 3-minute match, but the broadcast ended with Ric Flair versus Magnum TA in what was the NWA World Heavyweight Championship match. And in the broadcast, Larry Nelson would refer to the Ric Flair Magnum TA match as the final match on the show. So I'm still kind of a little confused about whether or not he actually did this live.
You always do great digging into certain aspects of shows.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I watched this, and I just assumed it was all done live. I didn't give as much thought into it. But I think, regardless, I thought the one-man performance of Larry Nelson,
he was great.
I mean, he was out there. So you have to figure he at least called it once live.
Perhaps.
Which, this was a 3-hour show without all the in-between breaks and in-between matches.
He had to do interviews.
He did pre-interviews. He did post-interviews.
Yeah.
This was probably a 4.5-hour event from start to finish. This guy was the MVP of this show, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So let's get into it. It was a big show. Larry Nelson opens with Vern Gagne calling it, ahead of time, the greatest night in the history of professional wrestling.
You can't really say that until after the
What match, a prediction.
Right?
And what a standard you're setting for yourself for the next 4 hours to achieve.
Yeah.
And he then interviewed Brad Rangins ahead of the first match.
We should mention where they are.
In Comiskey Park in Chicago, Illinois.
This was a baseball field, of course, where the White Sox play.
Yeah. How did you feel they shot this? Because they had people in the stands and then the ring kind of where the pitcher's mound would be.
It was definitely a case of perhaps the venue being too large. I mean,
you got no concept of there being 20,000 people here because there were only scattered seats that they actually allowed on the field with the majority all in the stands.
We're talking a baseball field that could probably sit, you know, like up to 50,000 people. And so 20,000, which is a great number, ends up looking like not even half of the place. So that said, though, I thought some of the most memorable parts of this show was simply seeing these wrestlers brawl on an actual baseball field with the grass on the field, brawling into the dugouts with all the media members circling around them. I thought those made for some great scenes.
Nothing beats a body slam on the grass.
Yeah, exactly. Or into a dugout.
Imagine a PTO on top of the dugout.
Damn. It would hurt.
Career ending.
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, on the one hand, it made for some interesting visuals, but I'd say overall, it kind of made the show look smaller than it probably was.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you got necessarily... I mean, the crowd noise was there, but not so much the visual of how big it is. Not all that different, in my opinion, than the recent UFC card in Melbourne, where as soon as the fights began, it could have been any arena in the world.
Well, that's the UFC's problem,
that's the UFC's production style, where, I mean, you have 50,000 plus people, and you don't get that.
Aside from some...
Compare
like,
that to, I mean, WWE. In scope, it's similar audiences as WrestleMania.
Yep.
And God, WWE... It's not even a race.
No, you
it's not even close to the production.
You can't fuck with the WWE in terms of production. Absolutely.
So the greatest night in the history of pro wrestling kicked off with Larry Nelson speaking to Brad Rangins, who said he's training for this light heavyweight title match like he was going for the gold medal in the 1980 Olympics, which were the Olympics that the U.S. Did not participate in, that he was favored to medal in.
But he did place fourth in the 76 Games in Montreal.
And then Brad Rangins would go on to be a pretty notable trainer in pro wrestling, helped get Brock Lesnar into professional wrestling. And he is challenging light heavyweight champion, the other Steve Regal.
Mr. Electricity.
Mr. Electricity. And
what are the chances that in the same line of work, there happens to be two Steven Regals?
Well, I mean, it's, I guess, Darren Matthews. Maybe he wanted some electricity into his ring name.
Come on.
So Regal then does an interview and calls Rangins a good amateur wrestler, but he is the best light heavyweight under 220 pounds. And I thought Regal got some very good heat in this match.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually been a while since I've seen it, so I didn't particularly note that. But
well, the match begins, and then this greatest night in pro wrestling jumps up another level because now Larry Nelson is identifying it as the most sensational night in professional wrestling. And should have saved that line for the Sherry Martel match, perhaps. And he notes that tonight we have 10 title matches on the show.
Well, this was like called Night of Champions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is now, hey, they took it right down to the month of the year that WWE puts on Night of Champions in September.
Yeah.
Regal won this title back in March of 1984. So he'd had this title a year and a half. And Rangins is attacking the left arm. There's a number of hammerlock switches. And then there is a pulling of the hair of Brad Rangins, though it was so quick that Nelson is unable to make a clear ruling if the hair was actually pulled. And this became a style of Larry Nelson's where he didn't outright say someone was cheating, but said that could be a choke, but it might be under the chin. He always left it open for interpretation as to was the heel cheating? You tell me. I don't know. I think he shot the gun right point blank, but he might be sleepwalking.
You could definitely tell the era of this show because Larry Nelson was treating every minor infringement of the rules as something very serious. Oh, you threw him over the top rope.
Yeah. Nothing,
call the match.
Nothing that makes an announcer look worse, though, when they call a ruling like that and the referee completely ignores it. Yeah. And the guy has to, well, I guess we're not going to call that a disqualification. Looked like one to me, but let's keep going. There were some light boring chants here during this long headlock spot, and then Reigns came back with chops, fired up for the comeback, back body drop, atomic drop, and then Jimmy Garvin shows up, jumping up onto the apron to distract the referee. Reigns knocks Garvin off for the big pop, and then there's a roll-up, which the camera misses, and Regal sneaks the pinfall at 8 minutes and 14 seconds, and then Reigns attacks Regal after the match as he retreats.
I found the match, you know, a little slower and methodical than the rest of the matches on the show. It wasn't particularly that memorable, but I think what I took from it just watching this first match was, I mean, last week we reviewed Survivor Series 1990, which was a show that only took place 5 years later, but it was a little jarring to see just how different the presentation of wrestling was here compared to that show, both in terms of, you know, obviously the WWF's higher level of television presentation, but also just in the physiques. These guys were big, but their definition was nowhere near as exaggerated as what you would get in WWF in 1990. Also, I found the in-ring a little bit more better, a little bit more realistic, and the characters the characters on this show were a lot more subdued and not as cartoonish.
This show didn't have an egg in left field that was going to hatch.
No, it didn't. No, I don't think it did. Might have been cut out.
Nelson interviews Regal. He said that Garvin did not interfere, and he did not pull Reigns' trunks during the finish, and Nelson giving his final judgment on Steve Regal, saying, "Your means are despicable."
Ooh.
Larry Nelson coming down hard on your light heavyweight champion. Nelson then interviews Sherry Martel, who is challenging for the women's title, and then he speaks to Candy Devine, and she just simply says, "We'll see who's tough," to set up our women's match. And they cut to Reigns, who is still taking it out on Regal, body slamming him on the infield grass. Crowd got more into the post-match attack than the actual match.
Now, would that hurt more or less than a body slam on a mat or, you know, on the floor outside? It's got to hurt less than a body slam on concrete.
I'll say this. When I was a stupid child and I was 12 or 13 years old, I was in sixth grade. And there was this guy who was a year older than me in this a grade above me. And, you know, a fairly built guy. And he was a wrestling fan, and so was I. And Sid had just started doing the choke slam. And my buddy was like, "Oh, I could do a choke slam." I was like, "Bullshit." I was like, "Choke slam me." And this was in the winter, outside in the yard.
Only you would be that curious to be.
I didn't think you could do it.
You would sacrifice your own body just to know if this guy could actually perform this move.
The worker inside of me, even at 12, I still did the little jump as he went for it, just naturally.
Of course.
And he chokeslammed me on the grass. In the winter,
okay.
Mind
I thought he was going to do it on snow, but he did it on
well,
grass.
There was snow on the grass, but
not
it was
enough to pad your fall.
No, when I landed, dude, I had so much respect for the choke slam. I was like, this, I would be done. It hurt like hell. I needed like a minute or two to get up. He killed me.
Oh my God! Wow.
So
and
to this thought, the body slam on the grass. I bet you Steve Regal felt it if he didn't take it right.
Were there any repercussions as a result of this incident?
I think it consisted of my buddy leaning over and saying, "I told you I could do it."
Oh damn!
It's like yeah.
It'd be great story if a kid got expelled for choke slam.
For a choke slam, yeah, we would have been celebrities in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
Wrestling move performed on 12-year-old results in expulsion.
You should be glad you weren't trying out the tombstone pile driver.
No, that would have been – or a pile driver. You know how many kids have probably tried pile drivers?
Mm-hmm.
Do not try that one.
No.
So we go to our women's title match. Title match number 2 of 10 with Candy Devine, no relation to Johnny, taking on Sherry Martel, no relation to Rick.
Yeah, I had never seen a Sherry outside of the WWF, so this was really cool to see her without that makeup.
Yes, Sherry Martel, Sensational, Sensual, Sister, every version of alliteration Sherry. This was pre-double S.
You made like more alliteration, more adjectives than Spider-Man.
I love that when she came to WCW, they felt, well, we can't just give her a completely new name. What sounds like Sensational? Sensual. Sensual Sherry.
Sensual.
That'll get around the legal
red tape. Not really the same meaning.
Though. Sensual Sherry. Martel shoves the referee away.
Sensitive
Sherry.
Yeah, that would have been made more.
That could have been
closer.
It. She just, anytime there's the referee yells at her, she cries.
Yeah.
And just gets the referee distracted through crying. The referee here was trying to give her a pat down, and she was none too pleased about this and was nearly attacking the referee.
She'd probably have a case today.
This could be harassment.
Yeah.
Borderline. Devine attacks the left arm. There was a closed fist by Martel for the heat, and then hits her with a head knocker. A head knocker, Larry Nelson proclaims.
What was that?
Devine's head was placed between the legs of Martel, and then Martel jumped up and stomped.
Oh.
The head knocker. And then she falls over. Devine gets tossed to the floor. She's crawling around the ring as Martel loses her. Devine was just too fast and then knocked her from behind, sending Martel over the top right after Nelson explains that it's an automatic disqualification, but then says he doesn't know what the actual ruling is here. As a clear, blatant disregard of the rules is being
displayed. He said he didn't know because he didn't know whose rule set they were following. Was it the AWA's or NWA's?
What a cop out. Catapults Martel onto her chest twice, then a Boston Crab is applied. It gets reversed. Nelson is constantly asking if Martel is using a closed fist or if it is an open hand, and then proclaims, leg drop onto the throat, or was it the chest? I don't know. I'm just saying it might be a disregarding of the rules.
I imagine calling a whole pay-per-view by yourself.
You're daunting.
You're talking to yourself for 3 hours, and I don't know many people who have even attempted that in their entire lives, to have a conversation with yourself. And I imagine when you get to that, when you're trying to do that, you probably say some pretty crazy things.
I can tell you that in my limited experience of doing commentary, mm-hmm. when I had to do the World Combat Games in Russia.
By yourself?
I had to do a number of events on my own, and believe me, being in an arena that holds about 20,000 people, and there's probably 100 in attendance, and they are all silent during like a wrestling match, mm-hmm. and it's your voice that is...
Your voice is on the speakers?
Not on the speakers, but it's loud enough that I'm the only one talking here.
Right.
It was just completely weird.
Yeah.
So... the match continues. Devine grabs the leg, wraps it around, or the left knee around the post. Body slam is delivered to Martel on the floor. Martel eventually fights back with a confirmed closed fist. Nelson was sure of it this time. And then a vertical suplex and an awkward splash from Martel as she wins the match 11 minutes, 24 seconds. And it took a couple seconds for Larry Nelson to compute that a new champion has been crowned in all of this. And Sherry Martel is the new women's champion and then attacks Candy with the championship belt.
Mm-hmm. The wrestling style in this match in particular was very old school. I mean, a lot of arm ringers, a lot of monkey flips. All the moves look a little slower, and the style is just overall like much safer. The girls aren't really hitting all that hard. But I wouldn't say it's bad. It's just it probably just was the style of the time, and I think we've definitely seen worse women's matches today. I thought Martel demonstrated great personality here. She played a great heel here that I think would have worked in any era.
Yeah. I mean, Sherry was a tremendous performer. Then Nelson speaks with Sherry, says that Devine had dodged her all this time, and calls her crazy. Then Nelson is with the three-man team of Harley Race and Bill and Scott Irwin. Race says he didn't travel all this way to get their asses kicked, and they're going to be taking on the all-Asian six-man tag team champions. Just the Asian six-man tag team champions. A completely fictitious championship to give to the Asian team.
Just to fit with the theme of the show.
Yes. That consisted of Giant Baba, Jumbo Tsuruta, and the recently retired Junichiro Tenryu.
Billed here as the Great Tenryu.
The Great Tenryu. And
it's too hard to say. Come on.
Well, Nelson consistently referred to him as Tenyaru.
Tenyaru.
During the match. Okay. Not as bad as the in-ring announcer, whose name I was not aware of, who introduced...
From Tokyo, Japan, Tasutra.
Tasutra. Jumbo Tasutra, which sounds like a book on sex positions that are designed for large men.
Jumbo Tasutra.
Nelson. I mean, this was 1985, folks. Nelson had some great lines here, including referring to Tenyaru as a young babyface kid who was a 35-year-old man in 1985.
So you and I are 31. Are we still in the womb at this point?
Or? We're not old enough yet to be young babyface kids. And then Nelson, he outlines the Harley team and then says, on the Oriental side, you have... And then listed off the team members.
So
different time way.
Listen, I actually love it. I mean, I feel like it's kind of refreshing to hear people, like to hear the announcer here just refer to the Japanese team as the Asians. The Asians with the advantage now.
Oh, the whites are running in. The whites are in control.
Yes. The blacks looking to come back and get a finish. I don't know.
The match begins. There's a big knee by Saruta to Race. I mean, a lot of talent in this match when you consider Tenryu, oh, yeah. Saruta, Harley.
It was a really cool snapshot of some legends here.
Yeah, at different stages of their careers. Obviously, Giant Baba here, very limited at this particular time in 1985, kind of just a figurehead representing the relationship of All Japan, who had, of course, involvement in this this particular show. There was a jumping bicycle kick by Bill Irwin to Tenryu, and then a high knee by Scott. Race hit a pile driver to Tenryu, and then Saruta made the save. The Irwins are double-teaming Tenyaru, and then Bill struggles to hit a back body drop as they get the heat on Tenryu. Hot tag is made to Jumbo. Baba throws Bill into the corner, and he bumps over the top to the floor. And then Bill Irwin busting out Candy Devine's head knocker, delivering it to Tenryu. And then all six are in the ring. It's a wild scene. And Baba hits a boot to Bill Irwin, and it's Baba that gets the fall at 10 minutes and 51 seconds. I wouldn't say a standout match, but,
no.
I mean, you looked at this overall show, a ton of talent on this particular show, and certainly in this particular match, whether it be influence, talent, history, a lot involved in this.
And that's why that's what I think I got most out of this match. Nothing in particular in ring, but I found myself just watching it more like a scrapbook of historic photos. And, you know, to be able to see... I had never seen a Giant Baba match before this. So just to be able to see this man move, to see what his chops looked like, and to see him on a team with Jumbo Saruta and Tenryu and Harley Race all in this baseball stadium was really a little bit strange and actually really cool to see. So, the whites did pretty well here, as did the Asians, and you know, it was just fun to watch these people in action. Not really for the match itself, but just to see them.
And appropriate that you use the word scrap, because many modern fans will remember Bill Irwin for his brief run in the WWF a decade later as the Goon.
Ah.
The hockey player turned pro wrestler.
Cool.
A highlight of his career, I'm sure.
Yeah, the heel babyface dynamic was a little confusing in this one, because I sensed the Asians were being portrayed as babyfaces here by the commentary and by the way the match was structured, I'm going to just call them the whites, with the whites getting a lot of the kind of the heel heat. But this crowd was certainly booing the Asians and cheering for the whites a lot more.
Well, this was a very patriotic crowd, as we would learn later in the show. And maybe it's appropriate way, being in a baseball stadium where you always say tie goes to the runner. In a case like this, for the heels, the heel is always defaulted to the whites.
Sure.
White men, they're always the heel.
Mm-hmm.
In a close situation. Nelson then interviews the whites. And he starts Harley screaming at Larry Nelson. And Ray says he is the legend of all wrestling. The legend of all of it. Okay. Then we went to a match that I'm sure, Wei, you enjoyed, or at least have thoughts on. Little Tokyo against Little Mr. T for the NWA Midget Championship.
Yeah.
I have never said a match description that is probably so offensive to different people. Little Tokyo versus Little Mr. T for the NWA Midget title.
Yes. I've actually had I think we've done like midget matches before, and I've actually had somebody write to me, you know, basically kind of instructing me about why the term midget is
offensive.
Oh. And I totally understood it. I try not to say it now.
Oh, okay.
But in this case, this was the name of the title. Like, I don't know what else to say. This is the World Midget Championship. There's no other way to describe this title. This is, you know, I can't rename the title. It's a World Midget Championship, and the World Midget Champion, Little Tokyo here, was defending it. But the thing is, though, the word midget here wasn't necessarily used in a derogatory sense. Nelson here was talking about Little Tokyo as a great champion. He was building him up like this was a serious athlete in a serious athletic competition.
And they didn't work this like your comedy midget match, which a lot of them would just go to the default, roll over the ref spots, bite him in the ass. There was none of that.
Yeah.
Little Tokyo, I mean, this was the stereotype of stereotypes, right down to him starting off the match wearing his pair of Gita? The shoes.
Oh, okay.
The wooden shoes that eventually fell off early on in the match. Mr. T was no-selling these punches to the head. I guess another stereotype that has moved on from black wrestlers, but is still prevalent among Samoan fighters for being hard-headed. Old stereotypes die very slowly in pro wrestling. And then his head gets knocked into the turnbuckle. Again, it doesn't affect him. So he headbutts Little Tokyo with his hard head, and Tokyo certainly sells that. And Larry Nelson, the ever-so analytical announcer, says, "If you kill the head, the body will die. And when you start squeezing the brains out of somebody, that's going to kill the head," during a headlock spot. Never has an announcer got more heat for a headlock spot than Larry Nelson here. Mm. If you kill the head, the body will die. That is a fact. Play GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Tokyo escapes a chin lock, and there's an Irish whip by T, and then he points up, distracting Little Tokyo, and then he just blasts him in the chest, and then the referee gets caught up looking in the sky, and then we hear a helicopter fly across the stadium.
Yeah, and I think this the point when the audiences were looking up and pretty much distracted from the match?
Yes, and I don't know if they worked that into the match or what was going on here. Tokyo then tries to point up, and Mr. T doesn't fall for it and nails Tokyo again. Mr. T then pulled out the rear view. Then he missed one. Tokyo gets back to the advantage, and Larry dropped the first of numerous lines where he described it as, "These two have been going at it, hammer and tong." And he used this. I've never heard this saying before.
Hammer and tong?
However,
I think I might have.
You've definitely heard it,
yeah.
Because Sunday night, watching the Survivor Series, it was either Michael Cole or JBL who used it.
I think it's a common, you know, saying.
I'd never heard it before Larry Nelson.
I mean,
and I'm convinced that Michael Cole or JBL were prepping for this week's review and watching the Super Clash.
It's one of those things that has probably died off in popular usage as of late.
Is a hammer and a tong, are those two real adversarial forces in the kitchen?
Hammer and tong is a real thing. Like, if you Google it, do you want me to Urban Dictionary hammer and tong? Hammer and tong, Australian slang, meaning to go hard at something, put all your effort and power into it, comes from the days when blacksmiths would hold flaming metal with tongs and bash it into shape.
Wow.
So it's I've never said it, but
I'm going to start saying it now.
I don't know.
Anytime there's a blood feud, that's going to be my go-to descriptor.
I don't know if I've ever seen, like, a hammer and a tong together.
It's a rare instance.
Yeah, hammer,
two forces.
Hammer and tong. I'm going to start using it.
It's a good term. Larry Nelson.
Yeah, hammer and tong. Yeah,
letting his vernacular live on. Tokyo escaped from a chin lock. There was an Irish whip by T. Sorry, I recapped all of that. And then There's a forearm to Mr. T as he comes off the ropes, and that led to Tokyo pinning him. 10.5 minutes this went, and then Larry Nelson with a rare flub on the show, stating that Tokyo successfully defended the Midget Tag Team Championship. Hmm. And then Nelson interviewed Tokyo afterwards.
I thought Tokyo looked really good here. I thought his transitions looked really smooth. His punches looked good. His wrestling just overall looked really smooth, really fluid. Mr. T, not so much. You have to wonder, you know, this.
And this guy did like nothing, Mr. T.
Yeah, how long was Mr. T's career?
I think it was like under 10 matches.
Okay, and was this a direct reaction to Mr. T's appearance at WrestleMania 1?
I would think so, just a playoff of Mr. T. I mean, Mr. T was a very popular figure, period, even without pro wrestling at this time in 1985.
So, but I agree with you. I thought the match went a little long. I found myself losing interest towards the end.
Very, too long. Yeah, I agree, on a show that was lengthy. Then we got the fast-forward animation, because the version we were watching that's up on YouTube was from 24/7, the on-demand service the WWF had prior to the network.
This is not up on the network, this show.
No, it is not. Yeah. We go then to another fictitious championship being fought over, this time the IWA heavyweight title, defended by Mil Máscaras against Buddy Roberts, because 9 titles, not enough. We need to have a 10th.
So what's the history between this one, this fake title?
Just wanted a title match.
But I mean,
it was a title at one point that was just largely dissolved, but Máscaras would be able to bill himself as a champion when he would go to different promotions in the States.
So the title was defunct, but he would still use it to, yeah.
That's my understanding.
Got it.
This was not a whole lot to this. It was joined in progress, first of all. Roberts was getting frustrated, constantly getting stopped by Máscaras, then gouged the eyes and was choking him with the tag rope. Roberts then lunged into the corner and was hanging upside down with his right leg caught. Then there was a top rope cross body, and Máscaras gets the win. Good reaction to the win. The crowd was into Mil Máscaras, who was very popular in the Northeast when he would come up and do the Madison Square Garden shows, because Máscaras would get exposure through the Spanish language network that was based out of the Northeast. Yeah. And then Nelson interviewed Máscaras, and I couldn't hear anything he was saying until, because they had like the house feed on.
Yeah.
And then it cut to him where he was just saying, "More action, more action," and then cut the rest of his promo.
You couldn't really hear much of the promos, especially for this match. But I like seeing what little we saw of Mil Máscaras here. I thought his lucha style was really fun to watch, in contrast to some of the slower American styles on the show, like that of Buddy Roberts. I thought Máscaras, you know, his flashy offense really stood out. And I think that's something very cool to a show, older show like this, because, you know, you watch wrestling today, and I think all current workers have a bit of lucha in them, a bit of lucha influence in them, a bit of, you know, flashy top rope. I feel like everybody does a Hurricanrana or knows how to do a reverse Hurricanrana these days.
That's day two of wrestling school.
But, you know, back then, I thought the styles were a lot more distinct and a lot more separate. You know, it's kind of like watching an early UFC with one background versus another background.
I'm just picturing Mil Máscaras in a UFC tournament.
Sure. His nephew was in MMA.
He'd climb to the top of the cage and then dive out and eliminate himself. The most famous Rumble elimination spot, perhaps. Then Larry Nelson interviewed, in my estimation, the biggest star on the show, Kerry Von Erich, who is here and is going to win this for his brother, who is currently in the hospital fighting for his life, Mike Von Erich, who had suffered a shoulder injury, went for surgery, and in a few days after the surgery, had a fever of 107 degrees and ended up being hospitalized. There was fear of him having brain damage and was diagnosed with toxic shock syndrome. Sadly, he would be released from the hospital and actually wrestle again, but then died in April of 1987 from suicide. So this was kind of in the midst of the mid-80s where, I mean, the Von Erich tragedies, it was just one after the other, and Kerry would be involved in that too years later. But on this show, Way, this guy felt like the biggest star in wrestling to me.
I agree. Just to see the amount of women that were crying,
literally tears,
to see this Adonis in front of their eyes.
I mean, Kerry Von Erich if you watch him in settings like this, with reactions he got, the look. I mean, he was never a good promo, but he had that awkward charm, like Jeff Hardy has, very much so.
Listen, and, is Justin Bieber a good promo? Maybe that's a bad comparison. Who's Justin Timberlake? Is he a good promo? I guess he's a
pretty charismatic individual.
I'm just trying to think of a really good looking.
Who's the Cary Von Erich of pop music? Is that your goal?
Trying to think of a really good looking guy who doesn't really have that much personality that women go crazy over.
Well, Cary Von Erich may be a league unto his own. He was taking on Jimmy Garvin for the world class Texas title. And Precious was in the corner of Jimmy Garvin, Jimmy Garvin's legitimate wife to this day. Garvin was heavily booed. This was easily, I think, the most heat on the show so far. Precious was constantly getting into Carrie's face, and this crowd just wanted to see Carrie strike this woman in a sign of the times in 1985, where the baby faces.
You'll still get that. Maybe not in WWE, but
other places.
Dixon Carter was put through a table. That was the big angle years ago.
As I said, old stereotypes die hard in pro wrestling. Carrie drop kicks him to the floor and starts mocking him, doing the Garvin strut, hit him with the discus punch, and then Garvin gets his foot on the rope from that. Carrie missed with a knee, allowing Garvin to get the heat. Crowd is just chanting for Carrie very loudly. Carrie is sent to the floor, hits a pair of discus punches, and it goes for the claws. The crowd goes nuts for that, and Garvin stops him. Carrie then runs into the corner. Garvin climbs up, takes a punch, gets crotched on the top, falls off, and Carrie just pins him. 6:51. Carrie gets the win. And then Precious once again gets into Carrie's face. Garvin attacks him from behind, leaps over, and then applies the claw. But Garvin then bails to the floor. And I'm not exaggerating. These girls who were crying, this guy won. He won the match and they were crying, are throwing roses. They're giving roses to Cary Von Erich.
Yeah, they're crying out of they're happy tears.
Oh,
happy
my God. Tears. Could you imagine? A six-minute match today, and the winner brings a crowd to tears. Anyone to tears.
Unless you're like a really young kid. I can't.
These were grown women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to think of like, what was the last like real heartthrob character that the WWE had?
Sheamus.
Yeah, well, he did make people cry. That's true.
I don't know. Who was like marketed as such? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
John Morrison? Would he qualify?
No, John Morrison never made people cry like this.
Well, I know he didn't make them cry. I'm saying a guy was like presented as your heartthrob.
No, I can't think. I mean,
by the way, I've never liked that. Like, if your heart was throbbing, I mean, that's pain. Throbbing is a pain.
Yeah, sure. You're so in love with this person
that they give you heartburn, or
that your heart is aching.
Like, what about like isn't there a better term than heartthrob? Like, heart. I don't know, like a more pleasant
sensitive
feeling. If I told you right now, do you want your heart to start throbbing?
Well, listen,
be like, no,
pain.
That's painful.
Love is sometimes painful, John.
Well, I guess so. Maybe that's where the tears came from.
But I mean, perhaps it might be Jeff Hardy. I'm trying.
Sure,
to think
sure.
Who
Jeff
else?
Hardy's a good one. The Hardys as a whole.
Sure. But Cary Von Erich on this show, wow, like it's incredible just to see these matches. Nothing really stood out to me.
No, as a wrestling show,
it was just more so for the atmosphere and to see just these characters in a different light. And for somebody like me who really has not seen much of this era's wrestling outside of the WWE, it was really cool to see people like Cary Von Erich with these types of reactions that they got in a setting like a big baseball stadium.
I feel that if you go back to that world-class period from, I would say, 1982 through 86, 87, what a period to go back and watch. If you were there at the Dallas Sportatorium when the Von Erichs were at their peak and feuding with the Freebirds, it's just like a level of being over that few performers have been. And it's a territory that's fascinating to go back and look at.
How much TV, like, how would let's say somebody in Chicago be exposed to Cary Von Erich?
World Class aired in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So they were familiar with the Von Erichs. Mm-hmm. I mean, the World Class, despite what you know, it's kind of been painted that the WWF was the first territory to have the idea of television going into other territories. I mean, that was, you know, Georgia Championship Wrestling and World Class. They were very much in tune with syndicating their television, getting into other markets, and the idea of touring and taking your talent. World Class aired in Israel, and they went, ended up going over there to tour. So, I mean, the Von Erichs were extremely popular, and this was certainly evidence of that, because I feel Kerry Von Erich was the top babyface on this show. Then we go to Nelson with the threesome of Nick Bockwinkel, Ray Stevens, and Larry Zbysko. This has to be way, from just a lineup standpoint, one of the most stacked shows in terms of talent in wrestling's history.
Yep.
This match alone, Stevens, who we've never reviewed a Ray Stevens match on this particular podcast, I don't believe, says that they're going to give a wrestling lesson. They go to Nick Bockwinkel, who simply says, ditto to Mr. Stevens. And then Larry threatens to put the baby faces in the hospital. And then we cut to the most bizarre three men ever together. Greg Gagne, who looked like he was auditioning for a comedy roast of Rambo. He was decked out in camouflage pants, a belly top. What was going on in Greg Gagne's wardrobe? I cannot tell you. He looked ridiculous.
Even for the 80s?
Even for the 80s. You have to see Greg Gagne's attire. Then we went to a 1985 version of Scott Hall, whose hair was brought to you by 1985 and mustache to boot, as the cowboy with his brown and yellow attire. I mean, Scott Hall delivering the most babyface Scott Hall promo you've ever heard in your life.
We'll find out who gives who a wrestling lesson, Larry. We're pumped up and ready for this one. We got our big man here, 6'8", 295 pounds. Take a look at him, Bockwinkel.
Scott Hall, they're going to come after you. They know you're strong. They'll try to outspeed you.
Well, I think we're ready for them, and I know I got two good partners here. I think we're all ready.
Who's got the experience factor, Kurt?
Everybody knows these men got more experience than anybody in the AWA in the world right now, but I'm going to tell you what. Chicago, we're ready, and we're coming to get them, so let's go do it.
They're on their way to America, Florida, Cleveland.
I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, yeah.
And then outdone by Kurt Squeaky Clean Hennig. I mean, just right out of the textbook of babyface promos.
Yeah.
This was amazing just to see the promos here from these three.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we largely chose this show because of Nick Bockwinkel's passing. And, you know, he's featured, of course, in this match. But we really could have picked the show for Big Scott Hall's appearance because it is Movember. And he was certainly rocking that Movember mustache big time. He's such a different personality than what we've come to know him as. Just in the way that he looked, in the way that he spoke. You would never for a second picture this dude playing a Scarface impersonation just several years later.
Yeah, I really can't see Vern Gagne sitting down and saying, "Yeah, you know, I'll get this kid over as some suck it chance." And yeah, sort of playing to his crotch. Well, we had well-known baseball announcer Jack Brickhouse, a longtime friend of Vern Gagne, and had called Cubs games from 1948 till 1981, so
that's a local
institution in Chicago.
I thought he took forever.
Oh, I love this. He gave the history of Chicago wrestling.
This is awful.
During his ring announcing gig. Talked about wrestling on Channel 9 when it aired three times a week for nine straight years. And then introduced heel Nick Bockwinkel as a friend of yours and mine, Nick Bockwinkel. I mean, he was just, this guy needed a drink and a cigar out there as he was doing
this. Dude, this guy took forever announcing these six names, okay? At the end of the announcement, he said that this match had a 45 limit time limit. By the time he was done, it was a 10-minute time limit.
He mentions Vern Gagne asking him to do this. And then brings up the one-hour draw that Vern and Lou Thesz had at the Marigold Arena in Chicago. And now representing Vern is his son. And you cut to this Greg Gagne decked out like a fool. He looked so ridiculous. I mean, Greg Gagne, he's a very underrated wrestler who I think.
Yeah, I thought he looked.
He got a lot of criticism because of his last name, which I think was very unwarranted. Didn't have the 1980s big muscled look, but he was a very good worker, yep. Especially his tag team work and, but his attire here. I mean, you thought that he was dressed for like some big street fight. This was just your traditional six man tag. That's all this was. Belly top. Ages horribly.
He knew that he was going to wrestle in a baseball field, so he wore the camo to hopefully to his advantage.
Well, unfortunately, we could see this because of videotape evidence. The referee was Larry Lazowski, the son of the Crusher, who would also be competing later on. The crowd got distracted with something that was going on, and Nelson called attention to this and said, "We can't tell what's going on in the crowd." Bockwinkel started off with Hennig and was cowering away as Hennig got the advantage. Hall comes in with his yellow and brown cowboy boots and has some like tassels on them as well. Nelson is just in awe of Scott Hall's muscles. He's just amazed.
Listen, I mean, Scott Hall really did look like a giant here amongst these six, and perhaps in on the show as a whole. I mean, I never really perceived him as one in the WWF or WCW, but here he was billed as the giant Scott Hall, and it kind of worked, I thought.
Yes.
He was certainly bigger than what
he was pretty jacked. Gagne comes off the top with a knee to the arm of Zbyszko as the babyfaces work over the left arm. Greg came in and hit a flying head scissors to Zbyszko. Heels got control of Hennig. Then he got slammed on the grass floor. And then there's an abdominal stretch applied by Zbyszko onto Hennig in the ring. Finally tags Gagne. Referee doesn't see it. Hennig continues to get double teamed. His neck got guillotined on the top by Bockwinkel. And then there was a mid-ring cross body collision. Both are down. This allows Hennig to make the hot tag to Gagne as the crowd explodes. And then they knock Zbyszko and Bockwinkel into each other. Stevens runs at Hall into a power slam, and Scott Hall pins Ray Stevens at 12 minutes and 24 seconds, and kind of a showcase of the past, present, and even future talent of the AWA in 1985. Nelson interviewed the winners. Gagne said they won due to youth and experience, which kind of contradict each other. And then Hall credits his two partners with helping him train. And then Hennig puts the exclamation point on the win, saying that they had to dig down deep and make that tag. This was hilarious.
Yeah, this was fun to watch simply because of the incarnations of these, in particular Kurt Hennig and Scott Hall, who I had only previously seen in this incarnation in the Wrestle Rock Rumble when they did their verse coming out of the Las Vegas some casino. I'm like, what the hell is this? I gotta watch more of this.
You can't fault the AWA for out of the box promotional ideas.
Decent match. We didn't get to see as much of Nick Bockwinkel here as I was hoping. Hopefully more in the future we'll get to see.
No, we have to review more AWA down
the
road.
Yeah, for sure. But it was a lot of fun to see this mix of guys. And in particular, I had heard so much, about Greg Gagne. I didn't think he looked so bad here. In terms of physique, he kind of looked out of place, but I thought he wrestled pretty well.
Then Larry Nelson interviews the Freebirds, Michael Hayes, Terry Gordy, and Buddy Roberts. Hayes says that this is the match everyone wants to see in order to see who is better. Their faces were all painted with the Confederate flag, just in case you forgot what year we're in.
Yeah,
probably couldn't get away with that today. And then we got this very distorted version of Bad Street USA that they came to the ring with.
Yeah, and they were, up to this point, the only team who came out with entrance music.
Mm-hmm.
Them and Kamala.
Yes, and then the Road Warriors, accompanied by Paul Ellering, they just steamrolled past Larry Nelson. They were not stopping for an interview. They were just going right to the ring.
Great.
And awesome. Totally fit the Warriors.
Yep.
And the scene of the Warriors getting mobbed on the way to the ring looked awesome.
In Comiskey Park.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it looked great. And of course, yeah, being in Chicago, the Warriors were a huge draw on this particular event. And a big tag match here with the Freebirds.
Do you know if they had faced prior to this?
I don't know if they had done any tag matches before.
But I imagine this would have been a dream match. You know,
this was you know, a key promoted match on the show.
Yeah.
We had Paul Ellering and Buddy Roberts in opposite corners, and Hayes just wanders out onto the field with the crowd chanting. I just like kind of the out of control nature of this mm-hmm. match and the scene.
I think you attribute a lot of that to somebody like Michael Hayes, who you know, again, nothing about the in ring here really impressed me, but you really have to admire somebody like Michael Hayes' ability to command the attention of this entire stadium in anything that he did. He oozed so much physical and I guess verbal charisma as well.
Yeah, this was 1985 when Terry Gordy was just one of the best big men in the industry at this particular time, and would only get better as he went into the late 80s, early 90s, and he started going over to Japan a lot more frequently. And Animal sends Gordy into the corner, does this big flip over into the corner. I mean, just the agility of this guy, who was he had to be 280, 300. And the fact that he was doing, you know, the flare bump into the corner was damn impressive. Gordy was nervous to tag in later when Hayes wanted out. Hawk then misses Gordy, runs shoulder first into the post, and then Gordy comes in, hits a pile driver to Hawk, beating down on Hawk, who then starts fighting back against both of them, tosses Hayes off the top, finally tags in Animal. There's a power slam to Gordy. Hayes makes the save. Then Paul Ellering decks Roberts on the floor, and Roberts comes back attacking Ellering with a chair shot. And these were those, they weren't the foldable chairs. They were like the seated chairs that had the plastic seat, and just like ripping them at guys when they would use these chairs. Animal ducks as Hayes then runs into Gordy, and then a press slam is delivered to Gordy by Animal. Hayes hits Animal with a foreign object behind the referee's back, and this allows Terry Gordy to get on top and pin Animal as they theoretically win the titles in 10 minutes, and this prompts Vern Gagne to come down to ringside and wants a replay on the Sports Vision. Let's get that replay up on the Sports Vision. And they show the illegal object being used, and it is ruled a disqualification, and there's no title change.
Come on.
I wonder if the fans could hear this ruling being made, or if some left thinking they had seen a new set of tag champions crowned.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of call some shenanigans here. This, the president of, he wants to keep the title on his own guys, obviously.
Well, they stayed on the Road Warriors, and Nelson then interviews the Russians, Ivan and Nikita Koloff, and a young Barry Darso under the moniker of Crusher Khrushchev, who were going to be taking on Baron Von Raschke, Dick the Bruiser, and the Crusher. Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher, legendary favorites within the AWA, in particular the Crusher, who was a pretty bad wrestler, but was so popular. Think of a Steve Austin character from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the guy who just constantly smoking the cigar, drinking beer, just your brawler. That was the big baby face in the territory who would just disappear during summers and then come back for programs, consistently drew throughout his career and put in the six-man tag. Ivan Koloff was bleeding almost immediately when this match began. This also for the NWA six-man tag titles, if you are keeping count of the title matches. There were USA chants as Baron Von Raschke was in there with Nikita Koloff, which was funny in and of itself. Dick the Bruiser got tagged in, went after Nikita, and then there was a punch from the Crusher off the apron, test of strength spot between the two. Then they got the advantage on the Bruiser as Khrushchev came in, taking a boot to the belly by Dick. Then they got the advantage on Baron Von Raschke, who hit a leg drop afterwards to Ivan. The Crusher tagged in. Baron then starts doing his goose stepping, which in 1985 was a babyface spot.
Baron Von Raschke with a leg across the chest. The goose step. This usually means the Baron's going to use the claw. And that is bad news for a bloody Ivan Koloff. He got him.
Great applause.
Great.
Yep.
And then signals for the claw onto Ivan Koloff.
I mean, I think people are very sensitive to things like that today. But I feel like eventually there's going to be a reaction to this politically correct overreaction in many cases. And I could see people goose-stepping, but doing it ironically and getting Babyface's reaction in the future.
JBL did it in 2004
in Germany
yeah. and caught a lot of
shit
for
it. It's an actual offense there.
Yes.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Much like Jericho stepping on the Brazilian flag mm-hmm. in Brazil. So, I mean, old school heel heat, it doesn't always translate to modern times or modern laws.
No.
But you think goose stepping might?
Well, I don't think this dude would have done. I imagine it would have been an offense to do it in Germany, even for him.
He was safe in Chicago
in 1985.
So after the big babyface reaction to a Baron von Raschke, he signals for the claw, but Crusher stops Crusher Khrushchev on the turnbuckle. Dick the Bruiser then attacks Nikita. They brawl to the floor by the announce desk, and we cut to the ring, and Larry Nelson says, "Somehow Baron has been pinned. I don't know exactly what happened." And the crowd starts chanting bullshit at around the 8:47 mark, and then the crowd is just stunned because the heroes all lost to the Russians. I don't know how this ended, and I don't even know what to say about it.
I don't know either.
This was a production overtook the match.
I really couldn't get into, you know, this the wrestling in here. It's enjoyable to see the personality, so.
Then, in a stroke of pure genius on our part, with no indication last week when we picked this show that this was on this particular show, Larry Nelson interviews Boris Zukov, who is getting ready for his match, with Sergeant Slaughter, the two men who would team up 5 years later as two members of the Mercenaries at the 1990 Survivor Series.
Wow,
here they are, 5 years earlier, at odds with one another's ideologies. And I had no clue what Zukov said here during his promo. And then Slaughter proclaims he will get justice for America. The USA is number one. And says there is no doubt who they're rooting for, as the cocky Slaughter then handed out American flags and was mobbed on the way to the ring. Sergeant Slaughter, if you go back during his WWF tenure prior to 85 and here in the AWA, I mean, Sergeant Slaughter was an incredibly popular babyface.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was defending America's honor against the communist Boris Zukov. And Boris attacked, and this was for the America's title.
The America's title.
Yes, this was a belt so big it fit right around the circumference of the White House.
Okay.
This was America's
title. And what is that, like their secondary championship?
I guess so. I guess it's literally their United States title.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So Boris attacks him before the bell, and we got this random pan into the crowd that Nelson acknowledges as we then just go right back to the ring during this production hiccup. Slaughter fights back, sends Boris into the post shoulder first, and he just flew to the floor. They're holding a U.S. flag in the ring, and as he taunts Zukov. Zukov then Irish whips Slaughter, who goes chest first into the corner and then lands on the floor. And Nelson says, if you could put the word evil into a tangible thing, it would be Boris Zukov.
Ooh.
Slaughter's then dropped throat first on the top as Boris had the heat. And Larry is just sneering. It says, look at the treachery in that man as he continues to beat down Slaughter. They then fought onto Nelson's announce desk. The table falls over and they show Nelson leaning over, informing the crowd, that's me! That's me! As he tried to stay in the shot as a bloody Slaughter is destroying his desk. And then Slaughter back body drops Boris onto the floor for a big pop. Slaughter goes for a clothesline, but then accidentally takes out Larry Lazowski, the referee. Zukov has a loaded elbow pad and hits Slaughter. Oh, sorry, this is when he starts bleeding. And the referee calls for the bell at 8:37. They brawl on the floor by the crowd. Slaughter's ruled the winner by DQ. And then Nelson interviews a bloody Slaughter who declares war on all foreign wrestlers. He's going to clean up America of trash, scum, and maggots like you, and says, I am G.I. Joe, and America will be no- America will be number one wherever he goes, with the notable exception of his second run with the WWF.
I thought the atmosphere was just really incredible here. Slaughter, I just think is seeing him here in comparison to last week, he just seemed to play a very good, intense, and very charismatic babyface. And, you know, I thought that was perhaps more apparent on this show. He stood out a lot more on this show than he did last week, because he seemed to be the only, you know, one of the most cartoonish characters out of everybody on the show, whereas in Survivor Series 1990 in the WWF, it seemed like everybody was an attempt at an exaggerated cartoon character.
We should also mention the lone sign that they showed in the crowd throughout this entire event was some fan who wrote, "Kill the commies."
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. He didn't single out any one of them, just all of them, I guess.
Yeah.
Harsh words from this audience in Chicago. Nelson then interviews Sheik Adnan El-Kaisi, who would later become General Adnan and would be part of Sergeant Slaughter's Iraqi sympathizer group in the WWF, along with Kamala, who is getting set for the Body Slam Challenge match, and he says he has a surprise. And it was Kamala taking on Jerry Blackwell in a $10,000 Body Slam Challenge. And there is a check that the announcer makes clear is right here in his hands. And Jerry Blackwell, announced from Stone Mountain, Georgia, joining the likes of Jake the Snake Roberts and Apollo Crews, representing the fine city of Stone Mountain. El-Kaisi says he has many surprises, and he wants silence in the auditorium. This auditorium that holds 20,000 people with an open-air stadium. For the Arabian National Anthem, which he sings himself, and Wally Carbo, the AWA matchmaker, is at ringside holding the $10,000 check for the winner. Very weak chops and offense from Kamala. Blackwell hits a clothesline and a splash. He went for the first body slam attempt, but Kamala blocked it. Kamala then knocks Blackwell down, pats his belly, splashes him, and then the referee goes down to count three, and Nelson asks, well, what good is that?
Yeah.
Nelson wasn't putting up with any shit this late in the show. There were more chops from Kamala, an avalanche in the corner by Blackwell after a reverse Irish whip, and then Kamala came out of the corner, got scoop slammed, and Jerry Blackwell was $10,000 richer after only 6 minutes and 44 seconds of work, and then Sheik Adnan El-Kaisi attacked him with a sword as Nelson pleaded for help.
He didn't stab him.
He did not stab him.
Why wouldn't you stab the guy? You got a sword.
He used the actual sword portion to hit him in the forehead.
Wait, what do you mean?
He was using the length of the sword to just hit him like an object.
But not the blade?
Well, it's kind
of... He used the flat part of the sword instead of the edge?
He didn't stab him with it. He used, yes.
Why would you carry a sword all the way out to the ring but not use the actual sword portion of the sword?
Well, maybe that was the surprise.
Why didn't you just carry
what part of the sword am I going to...
Why didn't you carry the sheath? Could have attacked him with the sheath.
Well, a pair of baby faces ran in who got tossed out of the ring. Then it was Baron Von Raschke who came in with a baseball bat to clear the ring. Very appropriate. Beats a hockey stick in a baseball arena. And Vern stops Baron on the floor from this wild scene as Jerry Blackwell hopefully was able to cash this check at a time when the AWA could still afford such a stipulation match.
Listen, the show was getting a bit long by this point. This was, like we said, a three-hour, 12-minute show. This was the third last match on the show. But I thought this was fun, you know? A show like this could use something different. And the goal here was simple. There wasn't much expectation for great wrestling. You just wanted to see one guy lift another big guy, and we kind of got that. So I didn't hate this.
Then we go to, I guess, our double main event way. First up, it was the AWA heavyweight title match. Rick Martel defending the title against Stan Hansen. And Hansen charges the ring with a cowbell, attacks Martel. Just a wild scene with Stan Hansen. They fight on the floor. Chairs are being used. Martel fights back, sends him into the post. The bell is ringing, and then they say the match has begun. and they're rolling on the mat. Hansen starts stomping Martel. They go back to the floor. The chair's used on Martel repeatedly. And then Martel grabs the chair and attacks Hansen with it. As the bell rings at all of 2 minutes and 5 seconds, they brawl on the field. Martel is dragged by the cowbell onto the field. Martel then comes back and slams Hansen onto the field. They fight into the dugout. And that was our AWA title match. That was your AWA main event portion.
And in the actual event, the live event itself, this actually closed the show. So I could
what a way to end the show.
You know, for your major title in a show put on by the home promotion, it can probably be seen as a disappointment. But, I mean, I try to imagine, okay, I just seen 20 minutes of Flair versus Magnum TA. This is really long into the show. I suppose I would be ready to go home to my house in Chicago. But I don't know. Maybe these people, you know, were probably a little bit disappointed.
Not to mention, this was the end of September. It's probably
cold.
A little chilly outside.
Yeah. So, you know, it was just an intense brawl. It was actually a very good brawl. You know, similar to maybe how a Raw would end.
And Stan Hansen would actually win the title from Martel in December of that year. And because of his commitments with All Japan Pro Wrestling, they did not want Hansen doing jobs in the States. So when it came time for Hansen to drop the title to Nick Bockwinkel, he ended up not losing to Bockwinkel, took the title with him. And then when they demanded it back, Hansen said, okay, I'll mail it to you. So what he did was he ran the title over with his truck.
Wow.
And with tire marks on the title, he mailed it back to the AWA.
Damn.
And then years later, somewhat apologized. He thought it was maybe a bit of a rash decision to run it over with his truck.
I'll say.
It's the kind of guy you're dealing with, Stan Hansen. Tough shit.
I guess, I mean, can they not just make another one?
They had to.
But I feel like to send it, like, why don't people just make new belts? Why do they need
them? They're not cheap, boy.
How much could they cost?
Yeah, a few thousand bucks for some of those championship belts.
These companies can't afford that?
Wait, this was getting into the lean times in the AWA.
I
a lot of stars were leaving. Things were drying up. Nelson was with Magnum TA, who was challenging for the NWA title. Says he will win if he hits the belly-to-belly. And then Flair is interviewed. Says he's going to take care of business. This was a year before Magnum's car wreck, which would end his wrestling career. Ric Flair, Magnum TA, NWA title match, began with some hammerlock exchanges, some strength spots from Magnum, and then isolating the left arm of Flair, who was then pleading for mercy. Nelson questions if Flair is as hurt as he's playing it up to be, and then Flair would hit some chops, and Nelson then patted himself on the back for his correct assessment of Flair playing possum. Magnum goes back to the left arm, and Flair fights back, applies an abdominal stretch. Gets caught for grabbing the trunks by referee Larry Lazowski, who then got into Flair's face. Magnum goes for the figure four as the crowd comes alive, but then Flair is selling it big, eventually getting the rope break. And then Flair goes and headbutts him in the abdomen, which Larry Nelson describes as Flair with a butt to the groin. Which I guess was somewhat appropriate. Magnum then went for a backslide, getting a near fall. Magnum went to the floor, got sent into the post. Nelson then brings up the brief title change from March of 1984 in New Zealand, where for 3 days, which the NWA never recognized, Flair dropped the title to Harley Race in New Zealand, won it back in Singapore, and though it's a title reign that's never really been acknowledged for Harley, because that would make it 8 title reigns for Harley. And then later, Race is referred to as a 7-time champion on this show. So some weird wrestling history in this particular one. And some timeline changes. He also never mentioned the fact that there was also the Kerry Von Erich title reign the prior year. He kind of just said that outside of a few days, Rick's had this title for almost 2 years at this point, glossing over some title changes. Flair then is attacking the left arm. He's in control, wraps it around the rope. Magnum comes out applying a sleeper, and then Magnum hits a splash. Flair gets his knees up, and once again, Nelson notes that Flair and Magnum have been going at it, hammer and tong. Flair then gets the figure four applied. Magnum turns it over, breaks out of it, goes for it again, inside cradle by Magnum for a two count. Then Flair gets tossed into the corner, flips over, goes to the floor, and then Flair is sent into the post, and this cuts Flair open from the forehead. Magnum attacks the cut. He's going for falls. Magnum then bridges from underneath into a backslide. The referee gets knocked over as Magnum is on top. Flair kicks out, and then there's an O'Connor roll out of the corner by Magnum, which Flair reverses, grabs the tights, and he pins Magnum TA. 25 minutes and 10 seconds this main event went, and Flair retains the title, not surprisingly. And afterwards, Flair insults the Chicago crowd, says they're not used to winners, they better get used to Ric Flair, and a fan yells, "You had him! You had him!" at Magnum. And Magnum just cuts a promo saying that it's a long way from being over with Ric Flair, and the show ends with a spent Larry Nelson leaning over the announce desk, looked like he hadn't shaved in days. He just looked ragged by the end of this show. This was an exhausted individual wrapping up the show. Mm-hmm. That was Super Clash 1985.
Yeah, yeah. I thought the match was like a good old school main event.
Probably the best match on the show.
Yeah, I'll say probably. And it's always a pleasure to see Ric Flair in this incarnation. You know, arguably in his prime. And the show overall, you know, I don't think there's much to speak of in terms of in-ring, but I think it was a great snapshot of all the personalities that were on the scene and not in the WWF at this time. And so for that, I really enjoyed this show.
All right. Well, that was Super Clash 85. I think from a historical point of view, Super Clash is not really a big... I think the concept was there. The idea was there. However, in actual execution, I didn't think this was all that great of a show. Some really legendary names that were a part of it. But I won't say a well-remembered show.
No.
I give this show maybe a 3.5 out of 10. It didn't do a whole lot for me. Though the scene was cool, it was in a different location than typical. Kerry Von Erich was a massive star on this show. The wrestling was fine, but I think it was a long show.
It was a long show, yeah. I give it maybe 4.5.
All right, well, let's go to the Law message board for some feedback. If you are so curious as to go back and relive Super Clash 85, it is up on YouTube in its entirety. And we go to Will from Mesa, Arizona, who must have been counting down to this show because his profile picture is of one Greg Gagne in his army attire. And Will says, as an AWA fan, I was very proud of this moment in their history, as it showed they were still able to put some good-sized crowds together. Being almost 2 years deep into the WWE's expansion era, even with the help of the Pro Wrestling USA joint banner, Chicago is the barometer of wrestling popularity. The fact that the AWA wouldn't be able to pull off more than 10,000 in the city after this event, while both the WWF and NWA pulled huge crowds in Chicago in 1986 and beyond, mirrors where pro wrestling was heading deep into the 80s. However, I'm perplexed at a few things. Was Brad Rangins a true light heavyweight contender? He still looked at least 225 to 230 here. I still have no idea why they were so light on contenders for this title. Greg Gagne, I'm sure, lied about his weight so he could be 3 pounds over the 215-pound limit and be considered a heavyweight contender instead. I don't know about these allegations about pro wrestling weights being exaggerated. I mean, that's a high accusation to be making in 1985. He goes, it was obvious watching the tag title match again that the Freebirds were booked to win the title once Vern got notice from the Road Warriors that they were leaving. The story goes that it was backstage at this event that Hayes and Gordy also broke the news that they were out as well. Thus, the screw job finish here, and a few weeks later when Garvin and Regal won the belts. Hayes was right. This feud still had enough heat and fuel for another year. We also found out that due to World Class's superb television syndication, that Kerry Von Erich had a good following in the Midwest. This was Kerry's first time wrestling in the Windy City. Vern should have done everything in his power to bring Kerry up in 1985 and transition the AWA title to him, with Hansen just being a temporary placeholder between Martel and Von Erich. We could have had some great Kerry versus Hennig matches later on that would have preceded their WWF feud. Sad to see the great Nick Bockwinkel hidden in a six-man tag. I would have loved for him to be in Magnum's place versus Flair instead. My rating is based on mostly nostalgia than match quality. I give Super Clash 85 8 laser dicks out of 10. Which, if you listen to Bauer and Pollock as a reference, you'll get.
Christian Small says, Looking at the show on paper, I was excited to give it a view. So many legendary names on one show and a chance to watch some guys I haven't seen much of. Sadly, though, I struggled to sit through it. This show really dragged for me, to be honest. I was only into the Bockwinkle six-man, the AWA tag title match, and Flair Magnum. I was also looking forward to Martel and Hanson, but that got thrown out for some reason. The only thing that took me out of the show was it being in a stadium. For some reason, it just looked Bush League to me. You struggled to hear any of the interviews, and one side being completely empty kept drawing my attention, even though it did draw a very impressive 20,000 plus, which puts to shame every TNA, ROH, and GFW baseball stadium show. The biggest positive on the show to me was how bad Greg Gagne looked. He easily takes the award for goofiest looking wrestler on the show, and that says a lot when you have Kamala on the same card.
Mick Whalen writes, to be honest, I was really hoping the WWE DVD on the AWA would be reviewed. When it lost, I accepted the result and watched the Super Clash. After finishing the show, I discovered I was totally right for wanting the DVD to win. I'm sorry, John and Way, but the wrong production won the Twitter poll. This is an argument against democracy here by Mick Whalen. I don't think we can approve this message. Nick Bockwinkle being relegated to a six-man when the WWE DVD had far more of Bockwinkle really soured the clash in my book. When you guys review the DVD eventually, I can then forgive those who chose the Super Clash over this DVD. All right, we got to get over this decision. Super Clash was a historic show, but not for its quality. The matches ranged from bad, such as Blackwell and Kamala, to decent, Flair against Magnum, but the real significance of the show is the aftermath. This was supposed to be the birth of the Pro Wrestling USA Super promotion to take on the WWF, but it only lasted one show as David Crockett of the NWA tried to sign almost every non-NWA performer on the show. Crockett and Vern disputed the live gate for the show, and thus the idea went up in flames.
Finally, we go to Jonas in Hamilton, who says, I gotta admit, most 80s wrestling is not my cup of tea at all, and this show was no exception. I was hoping you'd review the AWA DVD to get a decent history lesson and retrospective on a company I don't know a whole lot about. I sucked it up and watched the whole thing on YouTube during a very slow night at work. I struggled to keep my eyes open through most of it. The sound quality was horrible, the matches were extremely slow-paced, and a baseball stadium with a mostly empty field is a terrible location for a pro wrestling show. No atmosphere at all. The first match was okay, but then that women's match was horrendous. That top rope knee for the finish hurt my soul. The Flair TA match kept my hope alive, but when it arrived, it was a carbon copy of every other half-hearted Flair match I've ever seen. Also, what the fuck happened in the Road Warriors Freebirds match? That ending wasn't explained at all. 3 out of 10 show for me, and that's mostly based on a Jack Brickhouse appearance and Scott Hall's porn mustache. Question for John. Giant Baba was far from the oldest wrestler on the card, but he looked like he was 100. Was he sick already at this time, or simply that broken down? Also, thanks to Way for alerting me to rapgenius.com. It is my new obsession.
With Giant Baba, no, he wasn't sick at this point. And I mean, lived until he was 61. So you're looking at a guy who was only about 45, 46 at this particular time. He had definitely slowed down. He was largely relegated to this kind of role where he was working a lot of six-mans, multi-person matches, and was kind of just a mainstay figure in All Japan that was there for kind of symbolism much more than a top-end worker in the promotion or someone that they were building the company around. But he lived until 1999, so, I mean, he wasn't sick at this point. Just at that point, this was a guy in his mid-40s, so... And a guy that was, you know, a very big guy, too, that, I mean, I think that also very taxing on the body as you're getting into your latter stages of your career. So there you go. That was our look at the AWA Super Clash event from 1985. We're going to wrap up the show because Way and I have done some long-term booking. We have figured out, I think, the rest of the year for a review away. So you'll want to keep tuning back. We have some plans over the next few weeks. But that all begins with next week, Mr. Ting, because we roll into the month of December. And we're going to go back and we're going to review a show that is a very famous show with a very famous finish during a high point in the Attitude Era and the Monday Night Wars. We are going to review Starrcade 1998. Headlined by Bill Goldberg, defending the WCW title and his streak against Kevin Nash.
Whoa.
You know, Wade, now that we have had the perspective of looking at the Undertaker's streak ending with a lot of hindsight over the last year and a half, Now we're going to go and look at the end of Bill Goldberg's streak.
Nice.
And take a look at WCW as they decided to look at their audience in the face and say, yeah, you'll watch anything we show you. So that is coming up next week. Starrcade 98, which also features a singles match between Ric Flair and Eric Bischoff.
Yeah. Cool.
Cruiserweights in action.
Nice. Excellent.
It was, trivia note, the first pay-per-view I ever ordered.
Whoa.
Starrcade 1998.
Wow. Okay. That's the story I want to hear.
That's about it. I don't know how much more. I don't know if I can recreate the call to my local cable provider, which I did have to do at the time. Couldn't just order it on my remote.
Did you get your parents' permission?
I guess so, because they were the ones that had to get us a pay-per-view cable box.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. I will take everyone through the steps of how you ordered a pay-per-view in 1998.
Yes. I look forward to that.
For all you people out there, just simply turn on the network now that's there. Confirmation numbers. Calling in.
Quite a bit.
Talking to someone occasionally.
Credit card numbers.
Yeah. No, you didn't need that because your account would be on their system. And then you'd get a bill. You'd get a bill.
What's that?
Goldberg's first name. That's what it is. So there you go. That is going to be our review for next week. Of course, you can catch all of our shows up at liveaudiowrestling.com, including every single show in our history up on the Law Message Board. If you go to the archives, you can check that out. And Wei Ting is on Twitter at Wei0937. If you want to follow Teriyaki Experience on Twitter, they are big fans of Wei's.
No, they did retweet one of my tweets.
Your followers dwarf theirs. So I think they're trying to mooch off you.
Yeah.
I think a comp meal once in a while would go a long way.
Beef and rice.
Yes.
Some mushrooms and some bean sprouts. It's all you need.
Well, I'm already getting hungry now.
Yeah.
Just describing this. So taking us out is a well-remembered legacy point from the AWA. It would be the rap. The AWA.
Nice.
Wrestle Rock Rumble rap. That perfectly puts an exclamation point on the Super Clash event.
This should really end every show. Every review that we do, regardless of, you know, whether or not it has anything to do with the AWA. I can't get enough of this.
Yes. AWA rapping, folks.
Oh, and featuring Nick Bockwinkel.
A perfect end to today's show.
This is Ken Resnick, and I'm here to say we've got the greatest wrestlers in the AWA. But you're not here to listen to me mumble. Let's fill you in on the Wrestle Rock Rumble. Get on!
Wrestle Rock, be there.
We're the Midnight Rockers, Sean and Marty. We love to wrestle,
and we love to party.
You don't have to work,
we're not gonna fumble,
cause we'll be shaking through the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
Ow!
Wrestle Rock.
I'm the Sheik, and that's not funny. I got my army and lots of money. If Gunny in my way, I'll make him crumble. He be sorry, I did the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
Wrestle Rock, be there.
I'm Jerry Blackwell, and I want to see. I want to get my hands on that pencil neck geek, as I watch the EDF fumble. I'm going to make my splash in the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
The AWA, you, me, and Wrestle Rock.
I'm Greg Gagne, and I'm in a rage. I want Brody, and I want him in a cage. A high-flying dropkick will make him see double. I grind him up at the Wrestle Rock Rumble. Woo!
Wrestle Rock.
I'm Kurt Hennig
and Big Scott Hall. As tag team champs, we'll take on them all.
So bring on the Long Riders, those dirtball dumbos.
We'll smear those wusses,
do the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
I've got a passion. I'll get the title back from the humanoid Hanson. I've got the brains, and I'm not humble. I'll take the belt back and do the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
Wrestle Rock, Infotonia, at the Dome.
Wrestle Rock, 86, be there.
I won't be through till I get done slapping around Scott and the Two. Gonna beat the ugly bartender into a bundle and laugh all the way doing Wrestle Rock Rumble. Ow!
This game doc got a mouth that won't quit, but I'm Scott McGee and want to smack a little shit. And when I'm through, you won't be able to mumble. I'll be left alone doing the Razzle Rock Rumble. Yeah!
Just one last word from the former champ Vern, but give a lot of thought to one more turn. There's some old scores that still give me trouble, and I'm starting to get the urge to do the Razzle Rock Rumble.
So there you have it, and now you know him. And on April 20th, it's at the Dome. So get your ticket to be under the bubble, because you two can be doing the Wrestle Rock Rumble. Do it!
Wrestle Rock Rumble. Wrestle Rock Rumble.
That's the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
Wrestle Rock Rumble.
It was billed as Super Clash 85, a night of champions. It was called the greatest night in the history of professional wrestling. And I think you've got to admit that it lived up to its billing. Championship matches beginning to end, complete with grudge matches, a body slam match between two giants, every kind of thrill and spill you could think of. We almost got killed here at the table a couple of times when it got too close to us. The Kamala the Ugandan Giant came over here chopping once, and I had to flee. All in all, I want to thank everybody involved in this production, the camera people, the directors, the floor people. A sensational job. I'm Larry Nelson. Thanks for being with us.